Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. This Commodities and Energy Edition for Friday, June 26, 2026.
Today, we are examining the widening divergence between inflationary pressures and the Federal Reserve's current trajectory. While markets had priced in a steady easing cycle, the persistent reality of sticky core inflation is forcing a fundamental reassessment of the interest rate floor.
So the era of cheap capital might be sticking around longer than we hoped.
We can trace that further. That uncertainty is now bleeding directly into the macro landscape.
We begin by looking at the shifting dynamics of interest rates, inflation, and the Fed. The latest PCE report just landed, and it is not exactly a victory lap for the Fed. Inflation is still sitting above 4% when you include energy and 3% even when you strip it out. Today, we are digging into the macro plumbing, interest rates, the Fed's next move, and why the bond market is looking less like a safety net and more like a structural hazard.
It is a volatile environment, Maya. We are seeing this massive tension between the stabilizing effect of falling energy prices and the structural inflationary pressures coming from deglobalization and massive new capital expenditures.
It's hard not to feel a bit of whiplash. One minute we are celebrating a resolution to the Iran-US conflict, and the next we are staring at a 6% GDP deficit. It's like trying to drive a car where the brakes are being applied by the Fed and the accelerator is being floored by the Treasury.
That is actually a pretty accurate way to frame it. We are essentially moving from a regime of demand-side shocks, which fueled 30 years of disinflation, to a sequence of supply-side shocks, COVID, Ukraine, tariffs, and now the aftermath of the Iran conflict. This shift is breaking the traditional negative correlation between stocks and bonds. As BlackRock's Rosenberg argued, investors can no longer rely on long-duration bonds to act as a hedge when equity downturns are driven by these types of supply chain disruptions.
So the old buy bonds when stocks crash playbook is effectively dead?
For many, yes. The divine coincidence of monetary policy, where central banks could stabilize both growth and inflation, has been replaced by what some are calling a cursed conflict. When you have supply-side inflation, the Fed is forced into a corner. They hike rates to fight inflation, but those hikes can actually destabilize the very growth they are trying to protect.
And speaking of the Fed, let's talk about the man in the hot seat. Kevin Warsh has been signaling a very hawkish stance to prioritize price stability. Does his credibility actually matter if the underlying inflation is driven by things like AI infrastructure and tariffs?
It matters immensely for the long end of the curve. Rob Armstrong suggested that Warsh's hawkishness could actually stabilize the long end of the yield curve by providing the market with the certainty that inflation will be controlled. If investors believe the Fed is serious about hitting that 2% target, they might not demand such a massive risk premium on long-term debt. However, there is a huge disconnect in how the market is pricing this. Bloomberg Surveillance noted that market pricing of inflation is dangerously low. We are seeing a one-year inflation swap rate of roughly 2.3%, even though the three-month headline inflation print is sitting at 8%. There is a massive lag between the reality of energy and freight costs and what the swaps are telling us.
So the market is essentially being way too optimistic or just plain delusional?
It's definitely skewed to the upside. We are seeing persistent inflationary pressures from onshoring and friendshoring. Even if we see a gradual disinflation in the second half of 2026, the risk is heavily weighted toward much higher prices. If new rounds of tariffs are implemented later this year, those good sector disinflation trends we've seen could vanish instantly.
And then there is the nightmare scenario everyone is whispering about in the tech sectors. All this massive capital expenditure for AI, it's a huge driver of growth, but it's also a massive driver of inflation.
Seema Shah pointed out that structural drivers like AI capex will likely keep inflation above 2% well through 2027. This creates a catch-22 for the Fed. If they hike rates to combat the inflation caused by these massive investments, they risk a sudden, severe slowdown in the consumer base. We are looking at a K-shaped risk. Interest rate hikes might disproportionately hit low- and middle-income Americans who are already facing declining savings and rising credit usage.
It's almost like the Fed is being asked to perform surgery with a sledgehammer.
It certainly feels that way. And the scale of the fiscal deficit makes the surgery even more dangerous. Unhedged highlighted that the current market bubble is uniquely dangerous because, unlike the 2008 or 1989 crises, which were driven by household or corporate debt, the present excess is concentrated on the U.S. government balance sheet. We are seeing an unprecedented 6% GDP deficit during an economic expansion.
Which brings us to the death spiral theory. If the economy slows down, that deficit doesn't just stay at 6%, it expands.
Right.
Historically, U.S. deficits have expanded by about 4 percentage points during recessions. If we hit a downturn, we could see that deficit push toward 10% of GDP. We are already at a point where U.S. debt servicing costs have surpassed the national defense budget. This creates a massive risk of fiscal dominance, where the Fed's ability to act independently is compromised because they can't raise rates high enough to kill inflation without making the Treasury's interest payments completely unsustainable.
It is a terrifying feedback loop. You hike to stop inflation, the debt service explodes, the deficit widens, and suddenly you've triggered a fiscal crisis instead of a price stability one.
And we are seeing the early signs of that tension in the SOFR curve. There is a significant pricing anomaly right now, where the market is forecasting 3 interest rate hikes through early 2027, followed immediately by an aggressive 50 basis point cut. It is a sequence that is fundamentally inconsistent with standard economic cycles. It's almost like the market is trying to price in a controlled crash.
Let's pivot to Europe for a second because I don't think they are escaping this mess. I keep hearing that the ECB might actually be looking at the opposite problem, undershooting their targets.
There is a real divergence happening. While the US economy looks robust enough to support a hawkish Fed, the Eurozone is facing different pressures. Hugh Worthington suggested that falling Brent crude and natural gas prices could cause Eurozone inflation to undershoot targets in 2027 and 2028. In fact, FICC Focus noted that the ECB's inflation forecasts are likely overly optimistic. Their mild scenario assumes an oil price of $88 per barrel, but with Brent currently approaching $70, there is a massive risk they miss the target on the downside.
So the US is fighting a fire and Europe is worried about a frost.
The data tells a story. The volatility in the UK is even more acute. FICC Focus pointed out that UK gilts exhibit a high beta characteristic relative to US treasuries, meaning they can move 15 basis points for every 10 basis point move in treasuries due to the UK's structural propensity for higher inflation. The stability of the gilt market right now is largely tied to political personnel, specifically whether the Treasury chooses a fiscally conservative path or a more aggressive, net zero oriented approach.
It sounds like the entire global macro landscape is just one giant, interconnected game of musical chairs, and the music is starting to sound very distorted.
And the chairs are getting much more expensive to sit in. We are seeing a secular increase in term premium driven by everything from energy transitions to rising fiscal deficits. This is the end of the 30-year era of declining term premiums. Investors are having to move toward alpha-based diversification because the old correlations simply aren't there to protect you anymore.
So if you are a commodities investor, you can't just hide in gold or oil and hope the bond market stays quiet. You have to navigate the fact that the very idea of a safe haven is being rewritten by the Treasury's balance sheet.
The US fiscal deficit is essentially acting as a North Star for asset valuation. The sheer scale of that deficit growth is becoming a more powerful driver of high-quality, scarce asset prices than almost any traditional valuation metric.
It's a lot to digest. If you're an institutional investor, the calculation has fundamentally changed. Energy-driven inflation is forcing a total rethink of the long-term bond's role in a portfolio. Keep a close eye on the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield. If it breaches 5%, it could be the bell signaling the definitive end of this current expansion. But while the macro environment is getting much more expensive, the physical movement of goods is facing its own set of logistical nightmares. We are looking at a global energy market caught between two massive, opposing forces: the sudden, fragile peace of a diplomatic memorandum, and the physical reality of a shipping lane that feels more like a hostage situation every day. So, Alex, when it comes to the volatility in the Middle East and the Strait of Hormuz, which side of that tension are you betting on?
It's hard to bet when the fundamentals are essentially hallucinating, Maya. On one hand, you have the June 18th US-Iran Memorandum of Understanding signed at Versailles, which has temporarily unfreezed billions in assets and lifted sanctions for a 60-day window. On the other, you have the physical mechanics of the strait, where Iran is essentially using a double-edged sword strategy, linking the survival of the ceasefire with Hezbollah to the continued freedom of navigation in the Hormuz lanes.
A double-edged sword. Very dramatic. Are we talking about a strategic maneuver or just a high-stakes game of maritime chicken?
It's both, and the price is reflected in the tankers. According to experts Bakar Halabi and Nader Idiom, the traffic has shifted significantly. Large VLCC tankers are now actively avoiding Iranian territorial waters in favor of Omani lanes, which saw vessel counts drop to just 12 ships by June 21st. But the supply shock itself was actually neutralized by a very strange series of events. Everyone was bracing for a $200 oil spike when the strait closed earlier this year, but as Odlots noted, China's massive reduction in crude imports, falling by 5 million barrels per day through June 2026, effectively acted as a global stabilizer.
The world's biggest engine just decided to take its foot off the gas right when the fire started. That sounds less like a stabilizer and more like a coordinated way to prevent a global meltdown.
It's actually an emerging altruistic neighbor theory. The idea is that Beijing might be intentionally suppressing its import demand to prevent the economic collapse of nearby partners like South Korea, positioning itself as a regional leader while the US focuses on its pay-for-performance model with Iran. This creates a massive decoupling. While the Trump administration is pushing for verifiable milestones regarding enriched uranium to justify sanctions relief, the physical market is reacting to the paper versus physical divergence. This is a structural flaw where algorithmic trading, driven by headlines about the MOU, fails to account for the reality of tanker positioning and the skyrocketing cost of war risk insurance.
Okay, so the algorithms are reading the news, but the tankers are reading the sonar. But if the supply shock was neutralized, why are we still seeing Brent trading in this nervous range around the mid-70s?
Because the relief is incredibly brittle. You're currently in a state where the paper surplus projected by the IEA is structurally undermined by a massive 1.1 billion barrel global stock draw occurring between February and September 2022. You can have a peace deal, but if you're draining global inventories to cover the gap, you have no buffer left. If that 60-day window in August ends and the snapback of sanctions occurs, the market has zero margin for error.
And I assume the snapback isn't just a legal term, but a direct hit to the bottom line for anyone buying Persian Gulf crude.
So here's the picture. The US-Iran MOU has already triggered a reversal of diversification in Asia. S&P Global's Calvin Lee pointed out that Chinese independent refiners have actually suspended Atlantic Basin purchases to wait for cheaper Middle Eastern barrels to return. They are essentially pausing their strategic shift toward alternative crudes, betting that the MOU holds. But if the deadlock over navigation fees in the strait intensifies, specifically Iran's intention to charge fees for maritime services, that entire bet collapses.
It feels like we're all just waiting for a single invoice to arrive from Tehran to trigger the next crisis.
It's even more complex for the refiners. In the Atlantic Basin, we're seeing a double squeeze. Post-conflict refining margins are being eaten alive because the return of sour grades forces much heavier, more expensive processing loads onto refineries, even as the Singapore gas oil and jet fuel spreads have collapsed through late June. And if you look at the Americas, the volatility is leaking everywhere. Argus Media reported a perfect storm of disruptions, from the 2025 ban on the refit refinery to the way Petrobras's recent suspension of fuel auctions has forced an eightfold increase in gasoline imports to Brazilian ports like Santos and Paranaguá.
So the plumbing is breaking everywhere, not just in the strait.
Even the supply-side math has changed. According to Superspike, the Strait of Hormuz crisis doesn't actually require a return to pre-crisis production levels to stabilize. Because Saudi Arabia and the UAE have already redirected enough volume through pipelines to permanently reduce the required strait utilization rate to about 55 to 60% of its former capacity, the crisis is now more about the ability to move the oil, rather than the existence of the oil itself. The risk is no longer about whether the oil is pumped, but whether the logistics of physical delivery can survive the political whims of a messy peace.
It sounds like we're all just living in a state of geopolitical super volatility, where the only thing we can rely on is that the next headline will probably break a model.
And that's why the professionals are struggling. During the March-April period, as Oddlots observed, proprietary models were signaling raging buys based on fair value, but the unexpected price movements were so violent that risk management limits were throttled down by 90%. Everyone was bullish, but nobody was actually allowed to buy.
Asian independent refiners need to decide if they are sticking with the wait-and-see approach on Middle Eastern barrels before the August sanctions snapback hits.
Keep a very close eye on the vessel counts in the Omani territorial waters. If those large tankers start moving back into the direct Iranian lanes, the risk premium is coming back for good.
But if we can stabilize the flow of crude, does that same pressure apply to the massive surge in electricity demand we're seeing for the next generation of computing?
I cannot stop thinking about the massive physical reality check hitting the AI hype cycle. Everyone is obsessed with the software, but the real story is the hardware and the heavy electrons required to run it.
You mean the bottleneck trade? That sounds like a very polite way of saying we've run out of plugs and people who know how to wire them.
On Bloomberg Surveillance, Sebastian Page argued we need to move past investing in AI developers and start looking at the bottleneck supply chain, cooling, electrification, and power infrastructure. We're seeing a shift from a focus on GPUs to a massive demand for gas turbines, aerospace, and even plumbing.
Instead of betting on the smartest chatbot, we're betting on the person who can install the industrial-grade air conditioner.
Two things stand out, and the scale is staggering. We're moving from 50 megawatt requests to projects requiring a full gigawatt of power. This is creating a massive structural mismatch. As Argus Media noted, there is a fundamental incongruity in trying to use data centers as flexible grid loads to help stabilize the system when these facilities require 100% uptime. They can't just power down when the wind stops blowing.
Which sounds like a nightmare for grid operators in places like the UK, where data centers are already eating up huge chunks of local demand.
It's a zero-sum game. In West London, data centers are consuming 18% of local demand, effectively stalling new housing projects. We're seeing this clustering problem globally. In Norway, Statnett has actually suspended new connection requests above 5 megawatts in the north because the local generation and interconnections simply can't handle the surge.
So it's not just about having enough energy, it's about the physical wires actually being there.
And the wires take forever. In Germany, renewable approvals can happen in under 2 years, but building the distribution lines takes 8 to 12 years. This is why many analysts see a power moat forming. As MacroVoices pointed out, China has a massive competitive advantage here because their existing heavy industrial base provides the massive electrical and thermal energy required for large-scale computing.
So if you don't have the heavy industry, you don't have the AI.
Something to flag here, even the US strategy is pivoting. While the Trump administration has maintained technological immunity for 85% of air-related imports to protect capital expenditure, the domestic bottleneck is labor. We are facing a global shortage of the specialized electricians and construction workers needed to build these advanced centers.
It sounds like the cloud is actually just a very expensive, very thirsty pile of metal in a field.
And the most immediate solution is much more old school than anyone expected. Because advanced nuclear takes a decade to deploy, the industry is looking toward natural gas as the critical bridge fuel. In fact, there's already a massive push for long positions in December 2026 natural gas futures to capture that inevitable spike in demand.
Investors need to start watching the utility interconnection queues in the UK and Germany. Keep an eye on those private wire and off-grid power announcements from the big hyperscalers, because that will signal if they've finally given up on the public grid. But if we can't plug the AI into the existing grid, does that mean the future of energy lies in much more radical, localized solutions like fusion or carbon capture? We all thought the energy transition would be a straight line of solar panels scaling up and gas plants fading out, but instead, we're seeing a massive, messy pivot toward heavy atoms, industrial-scale carbon vacuums, and utilities acting like infrastructure landlords. It's gone from install more wind to how do we keep the lights on for AI while building a literal carbon capture empire, and where do we find the uranium that isn't caught in a geopolitical crossfire?
The complexity is definitely scaling. We're seeing a fundamental shift in the power generation mix, where the focus is moving from simple renewable capacity to managing the extreme intermittency of the grid.
And that's expensive. You can't just plug in a solar farm and call it a day when the sun goes down.
Worth noting, and Columbia Energy Exchange notes that the true economic cost of renewables is often obscured because we ignore the system-wide necessity of overbuilding storage and generation to match the reliability of baseload gas, which can make solar plus storage roughly 50% more expensive than combined cycle turbines before subsidies. This is why we're seeing a massive resurgence in large-scale nuclear.
Nuclear? I thought we were moving past the era of massive, multi-decade construction nightmares.
The goal now is moving from first-of-a-kind to nth-of-a-kind economics. As Grant Isaac of Cameco pointed out, the cost-saving learning curve seen in China and the UAE only happened because they kept building. We're seeing this play out with the AP1000 design in Poland and Bulgaria, which aims to neutralize risks in licensing and regulatory hurdles. Even in the US, the cost reduction from the Vogtle Unit 3 to Unit 4 shows that continuous deployment is the only way to break the cycle of expensive, bespoke projects.
But the West is still playing catch-up. It's hard to compete when the other guys are building at a fraction of the price.
That's the friction point. Michael Symbolist has highlighted a massive cost gap, noting that construction in China and India is estimated at only 20-25% of the cost of major Western projects, largely due to structural differences in regulatory hurdles and litigation risks. It's not that their tech is inherently superior, but their execution environment is much more streamlined.
So while the West struggles with permits, the AI giants are just buying their way into a solution.
Stepping back, companies like Anthropic are becoming major direct carbon removal buyers, bypassing traditional renewable PPAs. We're seeing a transition in the carbon market from avoidance credits to permanent, verifiable removals. Even Frontier is shifting its strategy from broad venture-style seeding to concentrated long-term offtakes with a few mature companies to ensure they can actually deliver promised tons of carbon removal on schedule.
It's a massive pivot from let's plant trees to let's build industrial-scale machines to suck CO2 out of the sky.
And the utilities are following. Engie, for example, has moved from pure power generation toward acquiring regulated network assets like UK Power Networks, effectively turning into an infrastructure platform. They're moving toward power couples, integrated partnerships where they manage everything from power landing to storage for data centers.
Investors in European grid operators need to watch how much of this custom solution demand actually translates to regulated returns. Keep an eye on the July regulatory revisions to the EU ETS to see if permanent removals officially become part of the compliance market. But if we're building all these massive reactors and carbon scrubbers, we're going to need a whole different set of ingredients. We've spent decades worrying about the scarcity of oil and coal, only to realize the real existential threat to the AI revolution is basically a handful of obscure metals that sound like something out of a fantasy novel.
It's not just the names, Maya, it's the structural physics of the market. You're moving from a software-centric AI boom toward a massive hardware expansion that requires materials far beyond traditional silicon, copper, or steel.
Right, because apparently you can't run a trillion-parameter model on just vibes and electricity.
No, you need gallium nitride to manage data center energy demands and indium phosphide for high-speed optical connectivity. But here's the catch. Argus Media noted that the growth of AI-driven data centers creates a fundamental structural vulnerability because metals like gallium and germanium are frequently produced as mere byproducts of other mining. This makes the supply incredibly inelastic. You can't just scale up a byproduct if the primary ore isn't being mined.
We're essentially at the mercy of whatever happens in unrelated mining sectors. That sounds remarkably inconvenient for anyone trying to build a GPU.
It's more than inconvenient, it's a geopolitical bottleneck. Cyan Morris highlighted that Chinese export restrictions on indium phosphide, combined with tantalum volatility driven by conflict in the DRC, are actively threatening supply. We're seeing a shift where the physical composition of the hardware becomes a strategic lever.
It's a lovely way to say the supply chain is a house of cards held together by specialized scrap metal.
There's a signal here to fix it. We have to move toward a secondary supply model, recovering germanium and gallium from waste streams and increasing material efficiency. But as Christina Belder pointed out, the current Chinese export controls are creating massive uncertainty for anyone planning data center construction.
Investors in the semiconductor space need to stop looking at software margins and start watching the scrap metal recycling rates in Europe and North America. Keep a very close eye on the next round of Chinese export filings for gallium. Any new restrictions will confirm that the hardware bottleneck is officially the new primary driver of energy-intensive computing costs. As we wrap up this edition, the throughline connecting everything we've discussed today is the brutal collision between digital ambition and physical limitation. We are seeing a fundamental decoupling where the rapid, intangible scaling of artificial intelligence is hitting the immovable wall of energy scarcity, strained maritime corridors, and a fractured monetary landscape. The era of seamless, low-cost expansion is being replaced by a period where the cost of moving a barrel of oil or building a high-voltage line matters far more than the next software update.
The implication runs deeper. The single most important implication here is that the calculus for global energy majors and infrastructure funds has fundamentally shifted from managing volume to managing volatility. It's no longer enough to just secure supply. The real profit and the real risk now lies in controlling the bottlenecks. For players like BlackRock or the developers of massive data centers in West London or Northern Norway, the primary constraint isn't capital or code, it's the physical ability to plug into a stable, high-capacity grid. If you can't secure the power and the specialized minerals, the AI revolution simply stalls at the substation.
It's a massive reevaluation of what constitutes a strategic asset. The focus is moving away from the algorithm and toward the atom and the ore.
Right.
So as we look ahead, keep a very close eye on the next round of US inflation printouts. If we see that headline figure continue to drift toward that 8% territory despite the Fed's attempts at stabilization, it will confirm that we are no longer dealing with transitory shocks, but a permanent supply-driven inflationary regime that will force a total restructuring of energy and commodity trade.
That's the signal that breaks the current market optimism. Thanks for joining us for this week's digest. We'll see you next Friday.